Welcome to radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to firehouse.com.
Welcome to the Leaders Toolbox on radio at firehouse.com. This show is hosted by Fire Chief Richard Gassaway. The show looks at the leadership topics from the line officer up to the chief officer and station management to working with firefighters in the line from the command presence. So welcome, Chief. I know we have a guest today. Can you let us know who's joining us?
Yep. Thanks, Pete, and thanks for all the listeners who tune into the Leaders Toolbox. I appreciate your feedback and your continued support. I'm really excited today because I have a very special guest, someone who I've known for many, many years in the fire service, all the way back to my days in Ohio and my time at the Fire Academy. And with us today, I have the program manager of the Executive Development Program for U.S. Fire Administration and the National Fire Academy, Chuck Burkell. Welcome, Chuck.
Hey, Rich, how are you? And greetings to all of our listeners.
Good. Thank you. Thanks for being on the show. Enjoy having you as a guest. Chuck, for the benefit of the listeners, why don't you tell us all a little bit about, your title is rather ominous, to be the program managers of the executive development at the Fire Academy. Why don't you tell the listeners about what that means and what your areas of contribution are to the fire service?
Sure. Well, we purposely tried to create an ominous title for the protection of the guilty, I guess, if you will. the U.S. Fire Administration and its National Fire Academy for many years now has tried to divide its curriculum focus and curriculum content in a number of areas. And one of those we call executive development. And this goes all the way back essentially to the early 1980s. And within executive development or executive education, we're looking primarily at leadership and management development content curriculum activities that targets or identifies senior fire executives, so the chief of department, second and third level chiefs. And even now and for a number of years within the executive fire officer program, we have what we call a key leader component, which attempts to identify mid-level officers, even company officers, that have already demonstrated some significant leadership competency and outcomes, and then thereby they become qualified to participate in EFO. So I've had the pleasure of being with the fire administration going all the way back to 1980, which incidentally this facility in Emmitsburg opened in January of 1980. I arrived that December, so it's been a real journey for the past 28 years. And prior to that point, I was, as you alluded to, Rich, in the fire service in Ohio as a career paid member, and even prior to that was a volunteer in western Pennsylvania in the town that I grew up in.
Well, as a graduate of the Executive Fire Officer Program, I have to put a plug in for the National Fire Academy. And you were very humble in your descriptions, Chuck, but the Fire Academy is without a doubt the premier opportunity for fire service education that I've ever had the chance to be affiliated with. I've been to the Fire Academy no less than 15 times in my career, and I haven't had a bad experience. Every time the instructions, the instructors are top-notch, the curriculum is top-notch, the facilities are top-notch. The support on campus from Chuck to Dr. O'Neill to Dr. Kiefer all the way down is just exceptional. For anyone who's out there, who's listening to the Leaders Toolbox, who's never had the opportunity to go to the National Fire Academy, you don't have to be the chief of the department. Chuck's in charge of the program that's executive development, but there are programs from the line firefighter all the way up through, and I would encourage Pete to put the website for the Fire Academy and a link. Go in there and look at classes that are available. And if you can get the opportunity to go to the National Fire Academy, it will be among the pinnacle of your learning experiences in the fire service. I just can't speak highly enough about it.
Well, Rich, I certainly appreciate those affirmations and very kind comments. And yes, I've had a role in our executive education and the EFO program. In fact, being with EFO started in 1985, and for the most part, I've been with EFO for the total journey, with the exception of just a very couple of months in the beginning. We now have over 2,600 senior fire executives who are alumni of the EFO program. We currently have, or at any given time, over 800 fire officers, fire executives in the program. We intake about 200 a year. It's a four-year program, so the math is fairly simple in that 800 people is quite a few folks, men and women, to take care of, but we're proud of every one of them. And I think one of the overall goals that we attempt to achieve through EFO is a better understanding of the behavior of exercising leadership, which I think we're going to have the opportunity to chat a little bit about in the next few minutes, albeit we could talk about it for months. But, you know, there's a lot of confusion, not just within the fire service or even in our country, but globally. What leading actually is and what constitutes leading. There's a very famous author by the name of James McGregor Burns who once said there are as many definitions as those individuals who are willing to care to define it regarding leadership. So based on who we are and where we're from and our orientation to this notion of leading, we uniquely think about that process quite differently. And I think one of the areas where we really get into trouble with, again, by virtue of just sort of looking at our national landscape, is we have a lot of confusion between authority and leadership, that just because someone's a CEO or a fire chief or an elected official in a senior position, we automatically assume that they are, quote, a leader. And it doesn't, I mean, we can certainly realize when we say it that way that there is real danger in that, that we, sure, we can have a senior authority figure, but that person couldn't lead a leadership horse to water, so to speak. By the same token, we have senior executives and fire chiefs who are magnificent individuals when it comes to exercising leadership, but just to automatically assume that because somebody holds a senior position that they are a leader is very problematic. You know, you really cannot talk about leadership independent of purpose. So we really need to remember that. And so a lot of what we try to do in EFO over this four-year period of time, I think, is to dissect that and to try to give people the experiences and some of the skill areas where they can develop the capacity to exercise leadership and particularly to use their authority when it counts the most.
That's summed up very nicely. I couldn't agree with you more about the essence of leadership and how there is a distinct difference between being in a position of authority and actually being a leader. And part of what we're trying to accomplish here in the Leader's Toolbox is, in a small way, trying to develop those skill sets of leaders through the podcast program. And having Chuck as a guest today is going to help us to advance that along. And I'm going to turn it back to Pete because I know he's got a few questions that have come in from listeners, and we're going to give Chuck an opportunity to weigh in on a couple of these current fire service issues.
Okay.
Okay, gentlemen, thank you, and Chuck, thank you for joining us today. I really appreciate it, and we will have
a link. My pleasure.
A link for the USFA on the bottom of the podcast player page. The first question is, I'm the chief of training in a medium-sized career department with about 150 line personnel. I find it very difficult on reinforcing policies and procedures, as some of the chief officers within the department do not necessarily walk the talk. When this happens, it undermines what we are trying to do in training, and it certainly makes it difficult in reinforcing what the chief is trying to accomplish. Do you have any comments on this?
Wow. Well, I'm sure that that sounds like a question or an issue, problem, challenge that many individuals could probably write or write some variation of it. One thing that I thought of as you got into the second sentence of the question was that one of the metaphors that I often think about, you know, so here we have this chief of training in a fairly, you know, a good size organization, 150 folks, and he, I think as you said, is discovering that not everyone, particularly some of his colleagues, are behaving relative to their rhetoric or what they say is important. So one of the metaphors that I often think about is a metaphor of an air traffic controller and a radar screen. And as the air traffic controller looks at this radar screen, she or he may see certain aircraft on that screen and other aircraft do not appear. So if you take that metaphor and you apply the notion of every individual, every one of the 150 people in that fire department has their brain, in a sense, their mental capacity equates that of a radar screen. And if this chief of training is trying to get certain policies or procedures on the radar screen of each of those individuals, he or she may be successful in getting some of those, quote, aircraft or policies or procedures recognized, and others don't register at all. So this notion that attention is the currency of leadership, that is, you as the authority figure, the chief of training as the authority figure, is only going to be successful in leading if they can get the issue that they think is important, whether it's a safety issue, an operational issue. I was just reading an email today some stories about fuel costs, which is, as we all know, escalated through the roof. You know, if you're trying to bring attention or awareness within your department about conserving energy and fuel, and they don't think it's important, or they think it's bogus, then you're going to be relatively unsuccessful in being effective with that. So whatever you do as the authority figure to bring attention is critical, because without attention, and the other issue is that the problem more than likely is not going to be solved overnight. So you're going to have to raise an awareness or attention for maybe a very elongated or protracted period of time. And certainly that's a challenge, because, you know, the radar screen that somebody brings to work and their personal challenges, their family issues, their what they like to do for fun, that is constantly changing and often has more priority than maybe what the chief of training is trying to load into their screen. One of the other thoughts I had was, within this organization, the chief of training has to ask, well, who in my organization are the key influencers, both formally and informally? Because I think it's fair to say that in most organizations, we need to depend on allies. We also need to depend on individuals who take exception. Because if we listen to those individuals, our opponents, it allows us to hear their stories and their values, and it provides an opportunity to acknowledge what they're giving up by talking to them. And I think we're probably, most of us would say, more comfortable with the people who are supporting us, as opposed to the people who oppose us, but we can't forget about the individuals who take exception with us, because those are the individuals who hold maybe some key information to why perhaps people are not walking the talk, and maybe the actual undermining of issues and training that certainly may be occurring. When Rich said earlier the very name of this program is the Leader's Toolbox, the other thought that I had is, what if the chief brings into the room a toolbox and opens the cover of the toolbox up and pulls out a tool that is threatening to the group? And what I mean specifically by that, I'm reminded of a quote that Marty Linsky from the Kennedy School of Harvard often says, and he says, leadership is disappointing people at a rate that they can absorb. I think many of us have never really thought about leadership in that capacity, although we may have had some resemblances to it. But, you know, the act of leading in many instances is not walking around giving out money to people, but yet it is challenging people and holding people accountable to deal with problems in which we don't readily know or have the answers to. So I think the true act of leading is a very dynamic, painful process in many respects of groping and examining issues that need dealt with, but yet it's not going to be solved overnight. And the real issue is the change of behavior that's required, and it's not just by other people, but the actual fire chief or the authority figure themselves.
I'd like to jump in on this one a little bit, in that in the question the summary of the scenario, he said that they had chief officers who weren't necessarily in walking the talk and supporting or reinforcing the policies and procedures. And when I heard that question, one of the first things that jumped off the page for me was why. Why would you have chief officers who aren't reinforcing or supporting the policies and procedures? And I'm not even going to begin to speculate why. What I would encourage this chief of training to do is to talk to them and ask them why. What is it about what we're doing that you are challenged to not support? Maybe, maybe there's some policies and procedures that were written by training or by administration that just don't work good in the field. They're just not pliable or viable policies for out in the field. And I don't know, the details of those particular policies and procedures, but if the training chief were to talk to the operations chiefs and say, what is it about these policies or procedures, certain ones, hopefully it's not all of them, that you're challenged with in complying with them, and what could we do? Let's find the win-win. What can we do in adjusting the policies? What can you do in adjusting the way that you're leading the field crew, so that we can find a medium as to how to make these policies and procedures work? Because if we have policies and procedures and you as chief officers aren't following them, this is problematic. And maybe this is a message that comes from the chief, but here's the one thing that is a given and I think is universal, Chuck, is if in an organization there are policies and procedures that the leaders don't follow, then chances are the followers aren't going to follow, because the followers learn how to be good followers by imitating the leadership of the leaders. And I think it's an exception that you could find a follower that says, I've got a bad leader, but I'm going to go ahead and follow the rules as they're written, regardless of what my leader tells me to do. Most of the time, the followers will follow the lead of the leader, and when they're not setting a good example, then the followers fall in line, and then they're not setting a good example, and it snowballs into a big problem.
Right.
And I would think that there'd be an opportunity here to try to understand why these chiefs are challenged with these particular policies and procedures, and to understand where they're coming from, knowing that the organization, you talked to Chuck about it taking a long time. It'll take a long time, even if the chiefs do a 180 and start to follow and enforce the policies, it's going to still take a long time for that change to be institutionalized. And another thing that I think is a given is when you have a policy and procedure manual, and some of the policies are being followed and some of the policies are not being followed, I think that makes it difficult for a line person or anyone actually to say, which policies am I supposed to follow? The message I get is don't follow these, but the message I get is to follow these. So what among all the policies and procedures am I supposed to follow or not supposed to follow? And if you get to the point where, I hope it doesn't turn to this, but say you get to the point where it turns to discipline and you have an employee who isn't following a policy and you're going to discipline them, one of the first things they're going to say is, you can't discipline me. The chiefs don't follow the policy. How can you expect me to follow a policy that your own senior staff don't follow? Or I'm confused about what policies I'm supposed to follow. I'm supposed to follow these. I'm not supposed to follow these. I get mixed messages, and hopefully, if it's framed up this way for the chief officers, they'd understand that they're creating some problems for themselves by not being consistent to the department's and loyal to the department's policies and procedures, and picking and choosing only creates a broader problem to all policies and procedures of the department.
Yeah. I couldn't agree more, and a couple of things that I further thought about, Rich, as you were commenting, were, first of all, I'll say the latter one first, this whole aspect of organizational culture, which is essentially every organization has a culture, and the strength of the culture can be so powerful in either direction. In other words, reinforcing, let's say, for example, policies or procedures, or actually reducing the effectiveness. And sometimes the nuances are so veiled if there is a, let's say, a policy procedure manual, the real test, of course, is to be the fly on the wall and just observe what is done versus what is said, or what is done versus what is written. The other comment that I had when you first started commenting there, Rich, was this issue of communications, that I've had the opportunity to be in so many departments and just in terms of providing levels of assistance or whatever to them. And I'm not necessarily talking about large metro size fire service organizations, but even smaller ones. And I'm sometimes amazed that the senior staff of the organization really does not meet on a regular basis to talk. And, for example, they may meet once every 2 or 3 months as a group. And I think that that's just dysfunctional, that, and I know that it's challenging, but some way, somehow, we've got to figure out a way for managers to collectively meet face-to-face in a fairly frequent pattern to talk about the organization and to talk about what's going on and to communicate. And I think a failure to do that, where the organization basically goes on autopilot, over a short period of time, or maybe even extended period of time, things may seem to be going okay. But the result of that, I think for the most part, has a negative outcome.
I agree completely, Chuck. The component of the communications, especially among the senior staff, is so critical. It's easy for all of us to get caught up in doing our good job every day but in the process, not really be paying attention to how what we're doing is impacting someone else or how what they're doing is impacting us. You know, we're all kind of going on vacation, but in separate cars and not really talking about, you know, the trip and where we're going to stop and, you know, where we're going to visit and sightsee and everything, and then wonder, you know, Chuck ends up in California and I end up in Nevada and say, well, how did that happen? Well, we never stop to talk to each other about, you know, when we come up to this intersection, are we going to turn left or are we going to turn right? You know, it's so important for the senior staff of an organization to consistently communicate and be on the same page so that you know what they're doing, they know what you're doing, you understand, you know, what they're trying to accomplish, they understand what you're trying to accomplish, so that you can work in tandem. You know, what you described, Chuck, when you were describing that, what I was thinking about was a family. You know, imagine among your family if you and your spouse only talked once a month. Now, there'll probably be people out there who are tongue-in-cheek saying, geez, I wish I could get to that point, you know. But seriously, imagine if you're raising three or four kids and you've got all their activities going on and your job and your spouse's job and you know, the home to keep and the groceries to buy and the laundry to be done and the cars that need to go in for repairs, and the two of you never talk.
Right.
About how to coordinate all this happen. Who does what? Who's responsible for what? Who follows up with who? You know, you don't have those conversations, the car's going to end up getting taken for repairs twice. Honey, I took the car for repair today and dropped it off. What do you mean? I did that last week. Oh, I didn't know you did it. Well, yeah, we didn't get a chance to talk. And you end up with a whole bunch of these situations, which makes you frustrated, makes your spouse frustrated. In the organization, it's going to make the people who work for you frustrated, because
you're
going to be asking them to do work that somebody else has already done. So
we know in the fire service there are some logistical challenges. For example, if you have a senior command officer who works a 24 or a 16, and at the end of that, even though they're a senior member, maybe a member of the senior staff, you know, they want to go home, or they want to do whatever. And maybe they should go home at that particular point. But you know, at some nearby point, if they are a senior member of that organization and considered a part of that senior management team, or even a mid-level member of the management team, there is a need to have communication other than just a brief at the end of the shift or the work period. And you know, somehow organizations have to figure out a way to facilitate that ongoing communication.
I couldn't agree more. That's excellent advice. Well, hopefully that helps the chief of training put some ideas there down for him or her to be able to consider. Pete will turn
it
back to you.
I might add, Rich, if I could, that I have I have a lot of respect for people who are involved in training, and maybe because that's where I came from. You know, I always took training very seriously. I felt it was an honor to be an individual who was being given some level of attention, because, you know, trainers must have attention in order to get their message conveyed, whatever the content or the subject is. So trainers have a very important and unique role, whether it's recruit training, whether it's officer training or whatever. And I just want to pass on for those listeners who have some role or relationship to training, whether it's at the company level or whether it's complete responsibility, I applaud your efforts and you know, urge you to continue to do your best, because your role is so critical in terms of the future of your organization tomorrow.
Absolutely. It all starts and continues with the training that we do and how serious we take that. Okay, back to you, Pete.
All right, gentlemen, thank you very much. We will, if you do have any questions for the show, please do drop us an email to podcast@firehouse.com, and we'll be right back here on the Be Leaders Toolbox.
Radio@firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Welcome back to the Leader's Toolbox on Radio at Firehouse.com. And again, if you do have any questions for Chief Gassaway, please do send us an email to podcast@firehouse.com. Gentlemen, the second question comes in, and this is, hi, and thank you for your program. I am the fire chief in a small combination department. Our staffing is really a challenge, and paid personnel are often at odds with the volunteer call members. There are times when I feel that people in the department are just not paying attention to what I think is most important, particularly when it comes to prevention and risk education activities that we should be doing within our community. Do you have any suggestions?
So was this question written recently or 15 years ago?
Well, with the advent of email, I would assume it's over the last few years.
Yeah, I would suspect. Obviously, there are many, many combination departments in the country and provide their communities great service. It's a different staffing arrangement. Obviously, if you're oriented to an exclusively paid or career organization, or even oriented to a completely volunteer system. So, particularly, I think in communities where the transition of going, let's say, from volunteer to part paid, or to some paid members, or even to a fully paid organization, that transition can be represents change, and with that change comes the perception of at least of threat, and the threat or the sacrifice can take on many different forms, from money to power to recognition and so forth. So. I know this is not a direct response or my direct response to the question, but maybe I'm just thinking out loud here a little bit. And one of the reasons why there tends to be a fair amount of tension or disequilibrium involved when that transition is commencing, or even after a long period of time where the system has existed for many years and we still have conflict. Of course, we have conflict in any kind of organization. We have conflict. Rich, you were alluding earlier to families. We have conflict in just small family units. But first of all, let me say to our writer or to our person who emailed the question in, I applaud your position on being sensitive to prevention and risk management. That really is the future of our fire service and the future of fire protection, not just in our country but in the world. It obviously, and I know that this is a cliche and may sound fairly simplistic, but the very reason that the U.S. Fire Administration exists here in Emmitsburg and the National Fire Academy is there were people long ago who felt that we can be doing a better job with preventing fire and managing risk as opposed to reacting once the fire is burning. So I think we all recognize that, but certainly if we can advance and manage our risk better, then common sense says that we are in a better position otherwise. Some of the same issues I think that are contained within this question we touched on earlier, this whole issue of, you know, particularly when it comes to prevention and risk reduction, those are issues of attention that we need to think about. And one of the things that I was contemplating, Pete, as you read the question, I thought of residential sprinklers. You know, based on some data that I have, it appears that our national population of residents, there's about 1 to 2% of all homes in the country that are equipped with residential sprinklers. And when we look at fire service individuals, probably about 5, 6, 7% of fire service individuals have sprinklers. And those individuals involved with prevention and risk reduction, let's say fire marshals, either at the local level or state level, maybe around 8 or 9%. So said in another way, we are not doing much better than the population at large in terms of sprinklers. In other words, we haven't made the sacrifice or the commitment as an industry to embrace residential sprinklers. But at the same time, the rhetoric or what we're saying people should do is quite different than what we are doing ourselves. So in a sense, we are not necessarily walking the talk. So when the person who sent the question in said, I think he or she said, there are times when I feel that people in the department are just not paying attention to what I think is important. Well, maybe it's because you yourself or the writer hasn't necessarily fully embraced what they think is important. I mean, I don't know that for sure, but potentially, you know, we are human too, and we make mistakes, and therefore that provides an opportunity for the people that we're trying to persuade or influence to feel like, and I think it's the same conversation we had a few minutes ago, Rich, when we were talking about, you know, procedures and standard operating guidelines in terms of trying to interpret and determine, you know, what needs to be done and what level of emphasis needs to be here. Another comment that I have is that regarding prevention and risk management, you know, in our culture itself, it normally does not receive a lot of affirmation. So, you know, our larger American culture, unfortunately, typically does not prioritize risk management or prevention-related activities as much as we do other kinds of outcomes or behaviors. I mean, let's just talk about the behavior of wearing seatbelts. Now, we're doing better with that, but we're not there 100%, including fire service populations. I don't think there's an easy answer here. I don't think there's necessarily an easy answer. I think it's a variety of different behaviors that painfully need to be addressed. And this is an opportunity here certainly for leading, and a place to start is wherever, whatever it is that this person, they did not say explicitly, they just said when it comes to prevention and risk reduction, whatever those behaviors or activities are, I think it requires a full frontal assault by the authority figures to ensure that they're walking the talk here. And then secondly, I think they also need, when I'm talking about the chief and the authority figures, they need to recognize and reward. So many times we fail to do the necessary support kinds of activities and affirmations that people need to gradually make progress and know that those little baby steps are valued and appreciated to get to the larger goal of whatever is at stake there. So I guess those would be some of my comments on that particular question there.
I'm going to swing at it from a little different angle in that when I first heard of the question, and the chief said, you know, that the firefighters in the department aren't paying attention to what I, assuming the chief, what I think is important, I paused right there and said, well, they're paying attention to something. So if they're not paying attention to what you think is important, they must be paying attention to what they think is important. So I think we have a disconnect here because the chief thinks that prevention and risk reduction activities are very important, and I'm not disputing that. I think they are too. But it sounds as though he's frustrated, or he or she is frustrated, because there is a contingent of people in their organization who aren't buying into that, who are seeing something else as more important than prevention and risk reduction. And you know, he doesn't say it explicitly, so I'm going to go out on the limb here and say that these are probably – he's probably frustrated because these people are more focused on suppression than prevention and risk reduction activities. Why? Well, logic tells me because that's where you know, the glory is. You know, if you watch you know, hero shows on TV, you know, whether it's a fiction like Rescue Me or it's a documentary of real firefighters in action, you know, they don't show them doing prevention and risk reduction activities. They show them, you know, belly down in the dirt, you know, taking a hose line through the front door, the guts and the glory and the no fear stickers and all that stuff that is the glorified side of the fire service. And I'm sorry to be the one to admit what I think everybody would be willing to say is the prevention and the risk reduction stuff isn't sexy. You know, what's sexy is the hands-on, the get down and dirty, put the gear on and the tools in their hand. Chuck, think of how many fire schools, I don't know, you probably have the same experience I've had, how many fire schools you've been to, maybe where you're teaching a leadership class, and in your leadership class you have 10 people, and then you step outside on a break, and they're doing auto extrication, and there's 40 people, you know,
right.
and over in the Fire One class, you know, they closed out. They had to shut enrollment down. They had more students than they had interest for. You know, and why is because that gets the blood pumping. That gets people excited. And I think that the challenge here for this chief is to bring the message. Probably through the mission and the vision of the organization, bring the message forward that prevention and risk reduction is really where we make the difference in people's lives. You know, once our house catches on fire, you know, we're not going to make that big a difference. You know, you're looking at $100,000 to $200,000 loss, even if it's just the room and contents and nobody gets hurt. It's done. There's been a failure point there. Their lives are going to be incredibly disrupted. But if we can find a way to help them prevent that from happening, that's really, you know, the meat and potatoes of our reason for existing.
The dilemma is that an incident, whether it be, let's say, an extrication incident, vehicle accident, And we have a couple of crews go out and work that incident, and they're fairly successful in getting the people out. Yeah, there were some injuries. Yes, they were taken to the hospital, but they're going to survive. The crews feel fairly good about that because they get immediate feedback. They can feel and smell and sense that they had a distinctive role in helping those people.
Yes.
The dilemma is for... let's say a plans reviewer who sits down at a table over a period of 3 days reviewing plans that were submitted for a new medical building. That plans reviewer essentially inherently knows the value of what they're doing, but may never see in their lifetime when somebody discard some, let's say, smoking materials in a waste basket in a storage room, and because of the compartmentation or the early warning system or the sprinkler system that was installed to code, and that fire is contained within that room, they may never hear or receive that feedback 18 years from that point forward. So I think the challenge that we have is when we talk about life safety and fire prevention, code enforcement versus suppression, is how can we as authority figures lead the cause for these areas and through various activities that give people feedback and affirmation and, a good feeling sort of state in lieu of the kind of thing that you just described, Rich.
That's a challenge. Because, like you say, Chuck, when we get on the truck and we're going down the road, lights and sirens, we're going to have immediate feedback as to whether we were successful or not at making a difference. And these other things, the successes come slowly and more subtly over long.
And I hope our leaders or our listeners appreciate that we are not being critical of people who are doing that work today. I think what we're trying to reinforce is there is a better way. There is a better way to deal with risk, and because certainly our loss record and our fire death rate has a lot of room for improvement. And I don't know about your part of the country, Rich, but in my part of the country, I wake up just about every day and turn the TV on, as I did yesterday morning, and there was a fatal fire in Lebanon, Pennsylvania. And, you know, I live in South Central Pennsylvania in Gettysburg. And in South Central Pennsylvania, communities of Harrisburg and York and Lancaster and Lebanon, and then we start talking about Baltimore and Washington and Northern Virginia. I mean, a day doesn't go by where there are serious structural fires where people are being injured, dying, and in many cases, there are firefighter injuries, if not even an occasional firefighter fatality. And that's the challenge that we have, is we, you know, people who are in positions of authority, and some of these, our listeners, are senior fire chiefs, senior fire executives, you know, you've accepted the responsibility for your organization, and part of that responsibility is the public you serve. And I don't think any of us would say that, the purpose of our organization is to do more than just respond to fires. The purpose of our organization is to improve the quality of life that we live in. And, you know, that's a big challenge, particularly in the fiscal environment that we are living in today.
I agree. I want to address another part of this question where he says that his staffing is really a challenge, that his paid personnel are often at odds with the volunteer or call members. And I'm not sure if he's tying that into the prevention and community risk reduction or if he was actually trying to address up two issues with one swing. But in combination departments, and you said this early on, Chuck, that conflict is common in all organizations and in all relationships. But in fire departments that become combination or have been combination for a while, there tends to be this hypersensitivity from career people to volunteer people or volunteer people back to career people. And I think that part of that is, in some cases, this notion that one group represents a threat to the other. Career people would think, well, if it weren't for volunteer, we'd have more career people. So the volunteers represent a threat to my job security. And volunteers might think that career people represent a threat to the long history of the department being known for being a good volunteer department. And now you bring in career people, and the volunteer role is somehow diminished because there's career people. In the departments that I have seen that have become combination, it has been out of need in that the organization has become so busy and so complex that being able to continue to do it strictly volunteer is just, it's not viable. I mean, if you think about fire departments like you think of other organizations, think of, Microsoft. That'd be a good example. We might as well pick the big dog. Microsoft started in someone's garage. Well, they're not in that garage anymore, are they?
Yeah.
No, they outgrew that a long time ago. Well, when they outgrew the garage, they moved into a building somewhere. And then they outgrew that, and then they outgrew that. And there's no shame in the roots of the fact that of where they started. And the same with fire departments is the more complex you become, the more your city grows, the more types of calls you're responding to. Add in EMS, add in 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 call volume, and you start to become an organization that's so complex that trying to do it entirely with volunteer can become a challenge to where you need to add some career people. And I think that in talking with many volunteers, and that's where I started my tenure in the fire service, was in a volunteer department, and all departments I've been associated with have had part-time or volunteer personnel. I've never even been affiliated with a completely and an entirely career department, so I, you know, that's the whole basis of my experience. I think that some sense that there is this shame or this admission of defeat because we, you know, we had to hire career people. Well, really, what I have seen and as I have observed is these departments are just outgrowing their model, outgrowing the way that they provided service. You know, if you're in a department that's got five stations, you probably didn't always have five stations. You probably started with one, and then you added one, and then you added one. And as your community grew and your boundaries grew and your population grew, you added one, and now you're up to five. You know, it's the same thing with this transition from volunteer to combination. You know, there's no shame or discredit for growing as an organization to the point where you say we need to have some support in stabilizing the base of our service. And they're still in this combination department, and I suspect in most, a place for both career and volunteer people to work harmoniously. But it takes an effort on both the volunteer and the career person's behalf to set aside these hypersensitivities, you know, that somehow you're a threat to me or I'm a threat to you. And I think the best way, coming back to how we answered the first question, Chuck, is communication. Sit down and talk these things out. You know, what is it about what I do that bothers you? What is it about what you do that bothers me? And talk these things out. The more you know somebody, the better you know somebody, the more your relationship develops, the more you understand who they are and what drives them and what turns them on and what turns them off, the better you're going to have as a relationship. I mean, we're back to the family. You know, it's a matter of communicating and talking these things through. And you know, it pains me to hear this chief talk about this at odds between the career and volunteer. And I hear it a fair amount. I don't think he's got anything unique going on there. But, you know, the key to, I think, having that harmonious relationship between career and part-time people is to communicate, you know, and to make everyone equal in their positions. You know, I know I've seen departments where within a station there's the volunteer truck and then there's the paid truck, you know, and the volunteers don't get on the paid truck and the paid people don't get on the volunteer truck. Or, you know, this is the volunteer's day room and over here is the career person's day room. Well, when you're doing that and allowing that, you're just inviting segregation and problems into the organization. You know, everybody has to use the same equipment, be trained to the same level, wear the same uniform, serve the same customer the same way, regardless of whether it comes with a paycheck or it doesn't. And you know, we as leaders have the obligation to tear those walls down and not allow that kind of blatant segregation of the duties of our career and volunteer people.
Yeah, and I would add, Rich, that, you know, organizations are organisms. I mean, obviously they come from the same root word. So for an organism to survive, we know that it has to adapt. And I think you well illustrated the point that for a fire service organization to survive over a period of time, and there are certainly some very ancient fire service organizations in this country. I don't mean that in terms of level of professionalism. I mean in terms of just tenure of age. For that organization to survive over a period of time, it has to adapt to its context. And I think you illustrated that point very well. The comment that I wanted to add is I was sitting here thinking about what I would say are some excellent combination departments that I have come across over the years, and maybe some that are maybe quite not at the same level. And I think one of the differences has been the individuals who exercise leadership in those organizations. And they did that not necessarily only within the organization, but they did that within the community. Every jurisdiction or every community has to decide what package of fire protection they're going to offer and what they're willing to pay for that. And that conversation has to occur, just as you said, that communication has to occur. And it just doesn't only have to occur once, it has to occur constantly. Because as this context changes, as the environment changes, then that conversation needs to occur along with that context.
And also, you know, in the context of having that conversation happen continually, remember that, you know, elected leaders are coming and going.
Absolutely.
And they're busy, their priorities change, and you know, they've got a lot of things on their plate to think about, and, you know, you might tell them things three or four times, and they might say, boy, I don't remember that. And it's not that they're not smart people. It's just that they're extremely busy people, and most are part-time or volunteer leaders of their, you know, of their own as you know, mayors and city council, and they're juggling their careers and they're juggling their families, and you know, so this notion of continually and engaging in that discussion and those reminders is a very important point.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, hopefully we've got some things that'll help the chief of that small combination department. I'd certainly like to take this opportunity again, Chuck, to thank you for giving us the gift of your time.
Well, Rich, it was my pleasure, and certainly if any of our listeners have any questions regarding programs of the National Fire Academy or particularly the Executive Fire Officer Program, I would invite them to contact us. I think Pete is going to make that information available. I would like to add in closing, if I could, that the act of leading is a dangerous one, and the reason for that statement is that you're basically putting yourself out there and exposing yourself in trying to advance the issues that you feel are important, because the answers may not be known and quite well are not known, and you're out there seeking resolution to problems and issues for which you may have responsibility or authority for. But you're saying, I need some help to do this because with my authority, I can't make it happen. So you're making yourself vulnerable. But the final comment that I have is that if you don't do it, who will? And I hope certainly that all of our listeners step up to the plate for the causes and programs which they feel are important, and the questions that need to be asked to make them better.
That's an excellent point. You know, you said about the position of a leader is one that is dangerous. I think if you're not out there on the leading edge, and I've heard it often said, the bleeding edge of change and leading your organization, and if you're not out front, and if you're not the one that is taking the brunt of criticism and questions, then I'd question whether you're being a good and effective leader. If you take the safe road all the time and the safe position, and you stay neutral on issues, and you let other people take all the heat and all the fire, I don't know that you're being an effective leader. You got to be out there, you know. I think, Chuck, you know, you're from Gettysburg. I think of the Civil War, you know, and the best leaders were the ones on their horses out ahead of their entire brigade saying, follow me. You know, well, what happens when you're out ahead of everybody in the brigade saying, follow me? You're the first one to get shot at.
Yeah.
You know, and there's a lot of risk of being that kind of leader, but I think that's what the fire service needs is those kind of leaders that are willing to mount the horse and lead the charge and be the first one to have the bullets flying at them.
Yeah, one of the true roles of a leader is to provide service to others. And you mentioned Gettysburg in 1863. The individuals were providing service to others by illustrating to the fact that they were not afraid to be in the same position that they were asking their troops to be in. And they were being of service to them in that regard. I think, again, we talked earlier where our society has said that there's something sexy about leadership and that if you're in a certain position or role, you will reap all of these benefits, where in fact, I think the reality of the situation is that the real reward is from providing service to others, and that service in many instances is not sexy. It's hard work. It's painstaking in fashion, and it involves sacrifice.
I agree completely. And anyone out there who's been in a leadership role is shaking their head in the affirmative, because they know the kind of sacrifices and the importance of being seeing yourself as a servant to others that makes for successful leadership.
Yeah.
So thank you again, Chuck, for being
You're
my
welcome.
Guest on the Leader's Toolbox. And, Pete, we'll turn it back to you.
All right, gentlemen, again, thank you, Chuck. Thank you for joining us. If you do have any questions for the Leader's Toolbox, please send us an email to podcast@firehouse.com. And, Rich, you'll be teaching at Fire Rescue International. I just want to let the listeners know what you'll be doing and when we can find you in Denver.
Yep. Next week at the Firehouse Expo, we're doing a program on fireground command decision making and hosting a couple of podcast roundtables, one on firehouse management with Mark Emery, John Salka, and Dennis Compton. And then we're going to be doing a volunteer leadership podcast roundtable on Saturday. Then at Fire Rescue International, I'll be doing a program as well on fireground command decision making. So if you're in Baltimore or in Denver, please stop by and say hello and give me some direct feedback on the Leader's Toolbox. I'd appreciate meeting you.
Okay, gentlemen, thank you very much, and we'll see everybody again here on Radio at Firehouse.com next month.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.